Believe in yourself, cause it starts with you, and then everyone else will believe you too. And if it looks like you're the only believer around, just keep on believing, don't put yourself down, just believe.
Our guest tonight was one of nine children and grew up in Inkster, Michigan. He so loved baseball that he took a bus down Michigan Avenue each game and cleaned the seats to get to watch his beloved Detroit Tigers. He's been an assistant press secretary to President Ronald Reagan, a senior executive at National Geographic, and the president of the Baseball Hall of Fame. A modern-day Horatio Alger story, his name, Dale Petrosky. And I'm Jack Krasula. And this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR.
This is Anything Is Possible with Jack Krasula on News Talk 760 WJR.
We're with the most amazing man and somebody I really admire, Dale Petrosky. Dale, welcome. Welcome back home, and it's an honor to have you.
Well, thank you, Jack. Always great to be with you.
Can we start by talking about your childhood and your mom and your dad?
Yeah, sure. Love to. I was luckiest guy in the world to be born into the family I was born into. My mom and dad grew up in Lake Leelanau, Michigan, up near Traverse City, and this little community of people, and both from very good families. My dad was one of six children, and my mom was the youngest of three children, actually four children, but she lost a younger sister to leukemia when she was just 4 years old. And they had this great bedrock values. They brought up in the Catholic Church up there. Both of them went to St. Mary's in Lake Leelanau. And then my dad went into the service. They got married, and they came. They actually went to England, kind of interesting, and were there. My dad was there when Queen Elizabeth was coronated. He was standing on the streets of London watching her the procession go by. Since we've had a little bit of that lately over there, kind of interesting to reminisce about that. And then they lived in England. My older sister was born in England and then moved back to Detroit and settled in Detroit and started raising their nine children. I was the second oldest of nine children, and my mom and dad raised us in Inkster my first 16 years. Then they moved out to Birmingham, where they've been since 1971. And they just taught us the value of hard work and treating people the right way. And I just never could ever imagine being luckier than to have been born to them.
Nine brothers and sisters and two parents and a mansion, and a 1,500-square-foot mansion in Inkster. Dale, where did you get your love for baseball?
You know, it's interesting. I was when I was a little boy, I was about five or six, I can remember, and I got my first glove. My dad bought me my first glove, and every child wants their dad's attention, and so I loved to play catch with my dad. And then, you know, he'd take me to my first ball game at Tiger Stadium, and we'd watch the Tigers, and of course, that was magical to walk into that beautiful old ballpark and see the Tigers. And then I was a fairly good baseball player as a little boy, and so, you know, I think you like what you're good at. And so my brothers came along, and they liked baseball too. And we played with all of our friends and followed the Tigers. And Ernie was, you know, doing the radio games every night. People forget that in those days only 40 games a year were telecast. And so you had to rely on Ernie and WJR for 122 games on the radio. And so Ernie became, you know, one of the family. And I think Ernie probably had as much to do with it, along with my dad and my brothers, as anything in terms of this lifelong love affair with baseball.
Speaking about being pretty good, talk about the two summers you played for Kowalskis.
Yeah, I was very lucky. I went to high school my first 2 years at Inkster Cherry Hill, and was lucky enough to make the varsity as a sophomore, and I started. And my uncle, who worked with my dad at Star Furniture, had a customer who came in. His name was Vic Jonice, and Vic was a Tiger Scout, and he was also one of the coaches of Kowalski Sausage, this very elite travel team that was being put together in Detroit. And my Uncle Vern who now lives up in Traverse City, said to him, "Hey, my uncle's, my nephew's a pretty good ball player. He plays at Cherry Hill. He's a sophomore and he's starting." And about the fifth game of the year at Cherry Hill, I didn't know this, but Vic Jonese came to watch me play. And that day I hit a home run and had a couple of other hits. I think it was 3 for 4 with a home run. And he called me up. He didn't even stop to see me after the game, but he called me up that night and he said, "Son, I saw you play today, and I'd like to have you try out for this team called Kowalski, and we'll explain it to you this Saturday when you come to tryouts." So I went to the tryouts, and there were 85 of us that were invited from all over the city of Detroit, east side, west side, to try out for Kowalski, and 15 of us made it. I was lucky enough to be one of the 15, and I was the only starter, day-to-day player, who was 15 on that team. Everybody else was 16. And we had two pitchers who were also 15, Doug Thomas from Austin High School and Joe Thies from Grosse Pointe North. And so the three of us were 15. We played on the national championship team when we were 15, and we were also lucky enough to play on the national championship team when we were 16. And on that team, that second team, was two future major leaguers. Todd Cruz was the shortstop. I was the second baseman. And Larry Sorensen was our star pitcher on that second team. And, of course, they both went on to major league careers of about 8 or 9 years. So it was great fun, and it really expanded my knowledge not only of baseball but the city of Detroit. I played with kids from all over the city, east side, west side, and it was a ball.
How do you explain the love affair between America and baseball, Dale?
You know, it's an interesting thing. I think there's a couple of things. The history, it goes way back, and there was a long time when baseball was it. There was no professional football. There was no professional basketball. Hockey was pretty much relegated to Canada, except for a few northern cities like Detroit and Chicago, Boston, New York. And so baseball had it to, had the country to itself up until, let's say, the 50s. And so there was this great tradition of passing it down father to son, mother to daughter. And I think that had a lot to do with it. The other thing is, and I tend to equate baseball a lot to the reason that the Catholic Church has a big following, and it's this. You can go into a church and love the incense and the formality and the traditions, and that's why you love your church. In baseball, you can go to the game and just love the hot dogs and the smell of the smell of the ballpark. And, being in the sunshine in the summer, and that's a reason enough to love baseball. Or you can go to the other extreme, and in religion, you can know every verse of the Bible from start to finish. And so you've got the people who either like it in a very general way or in a very detailed way. And the same is true on that baseball spectrum. You can get the people who just love being in the ballpark, and that's the reason they love it, or they love it on the other end of the spectrum. They know every stat about every player who ever played. And so there's a lot of people in between there on both counts. So I think there's something for everybody, and I think that's one of the reasons baseball is so popular.
We're talking to Dale Petrosky. When we come back, we'll ask him how he ever got a job in the White House. And I'm Jack Rasul, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR.
You're listening to Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR.
Welcome back. We're with Dale Petrosky. Dale, let's jump ahead. 1985, you're 29 years old, and you get a job in the White House. How did that ever happen?
You know, people don't believe this story, but it actually happened. Back in 1983, I was working for Congressman Bill Goodling of Pennsylvania, and he had an event up in his district. Our district was just 100 miles north of Washington, so it was easy to get to, York, Pennsylvania. And he had invited Larry Speaks, the president's press secretary, to be the main guest that night and the featured guest. And the congressman called me in the morning. He said, "Dale, you know, I'm tied up here, and I'm just not going to be able to get back down there to help to escort Larry up to the district. So you're going to have to do this by yourself." And so he said, "Take care of him, make sure that he's well taken care of at the event if I'm busy, and introduce him around to people." And so on the flight up, and it was a short flight, but Larry and I hit it off right away, and we talked a lot of baseball. He loves baseball, and we somehow got into a baseball conversation, and we talked a lot of politics and White House politics. I was fascinated by what a White House press secretary does. And so we got up to the event, and I introduced him around, and then got back on the plane, and we were fast friends by that point, and talked more baseball and talked more politics. The next day, I wrote him a note telling him how much I enjoyed being with him, and he wrote me a note telling me the same thing, and that was it. Didn't see him for until I got a phone call about a year and a half later. I was sitting in my office on Capitol Hill. Actually, it was 3 days before I was going down to Lakeland to see the Tigers play in spring training. And my secretary said, "Dale, there's Larry Speaks is on the line." And I said, "Larry Speaks? He never calls me." And he got on the line and he said, "Dale, long time no talk. I'll get right to the point. I'd like to have you come down and work for the president and me." And I was, you could have picked up my jaw off the floor. I had no idea. And he said, "You know, I always told my staff after that trip we took up to Pennsylvania a couple of years ago, I came back and put your business card in my top drawer, and I told my staff if ever we're going to hire somebody, when somebody leaves, this is the guy we're going to hire." And that was it. I went down to the White House and interviewed with Larry, and still couldn't believe it. I'll never forget. It was March 15th. It was the Ides of March. And in the White House, in the West Wing, the senior guys have fireplaces in their offices. And he had a fire going in his office, and it was just surreal. It was a beautiful moment. And he said to me, "So what do you think?" And I said, "Well, what do you mean, what do I think?" He said, "Would you like the job?" And I said, "Now, are you telling me that you're offering me a job? I can walk outside the gates of this White House and find a payphone and call my wife and tell her that you've offered me a job at the White House?" He said, "Yes." And I still couldn't believe it. So that's how it happened. And I had two amazing years there, fantastic years there, and, of course, with one of the great presidents of all time.
You were instrumental in helping Ernie Harwell meet with President Ronald Reagan.
Yeah, well, I love to do, you know, fun things for people I admire and people who have done nice things for me. And the Tigers were playing in Baltimore, and I invited Ernie down to the White House, and I had it all arranged that the president would have a couple of minutes with Ernie, and I thought this was perfect because they were both baseball broadcasters. You'll remember President Reagan did the Chicago Cubs games for WHO early in his career, and he loved baseball. And so Ernie came down, and he thought he was just going to have lunch with me in the mess. And I said, "Yeah, Ernie, come with me." And so we walked into the office outside the Oval Office, and his assistant Kathy Osborne knew we were coming and said, "Just wait here for a minute." All of a sudden, the door opened, and there was the president in the Oval Office. Said, "Ernie, come on in." And we came in, and they had a wonderful conversation for a few minutes about baseball broadcasting. And Ernie brought his book, Tuned to Baseball, with him, and asked. I think he just was going to leave it with me to give to the president. And he had it with him in his hand, and he asked the president to sign it, and the president did. And it was just one of those great, wonderful moments with two wonderful human beings.
You tell a terrific little story about Ernie and his telling you about the choice of being right or kind. Can you share that with us?
Yeah. You know, I was with Ernie a few years ago, and I don't know what the circumstances were, but he said to me, "Dale, if you have a choice of being right or kind, always choose kind." And I've never forgotten that. You know, we can be with people, and if their fact is 10% off, we interrupt them, right, to say, "No, it wasn't that way, it was this way." And by him telling me that, is he really gave me license for the rest of my life to let that go and say, "Look, you know, just be kind. Just always be kind." And I think kindness trumps everything.
Dale Petrosky, when President Reagan died a few years ago, the outpouring of love over that next week throughout America was unbelievable. Why?
You know, it shocked me a little bit because there were a lot of people in the country when the president was president who were not supportive of his policies. You know, he was a very strong president, both on the domestic side and on the foreign policy side. And, you know, a lot of folks didn't go along with what he was pushing and what he actually was able to get done. But as time went on, I think what people realized about him was this was a strong leader and a good man who just looked for the best in everybody. He was not a bomb thrower. He was not somebody who was on one side of the political aisle and demonized people on the other side of the political aisle. You could disagree with Ronald Reagan, and he treated you with respect. And he and Tip O'Neill got along famously. Tip had to do what he had to do politically to run that Democratic caucus in the House, and Ronald Reagan had to do what he had to do. But you never heard Ronald Reagan say a negative word about any other politician or anybody else. And I think people love the civility of that and realize that this was a big man. He was a big man in many ways, but he was a big man in that he had respect for everyone he came into contact with.
From 88 to 99, you were senior vice president at National Geographic. And then in 1999, you become the president of the Baseball Hall of Fame. How did that ever happen?
Well, I was at National Geographic and loving life. I was one of the top five people at National Geographic, had a chance to be president of National Geographic, in fact, because I was the youngest of those top five. And one day, a friend of mine in Washington, who I had known for a long time, David Bechtel, who has a summer home, his family has a summer home in Cooperstown, called me and said, "Dale, there's a job you need to have." He said, "The presidency of the Baseball Hall of Fame is coming open, and I think you're the guy for that." And, you know, it was a long shot. I thought there must be 100 people around the country who want that job. And so I went home and talked to Ann about it. We had just remodeled a home. We had been outside of our home for 14 months while it was being remodeled. We were living with her mother, who lived about 10 miles away during that time, with three little kids, which was a bit of a hardship, although her mother's wonderful. She said, "You know what? If in your heart you want to do this, go for it. What's the harm in trying?" So I tossed my hat in the ring, and lo and behold, I was chosen. And I started that job on July 15th, 1999. And a few days later, the biggest induction in Cooperstown history happened. Nolan Ryan, George Brett, Orlando Cepeda, and Robin Yount. And there I was, leaving Washington and National Geographic for little Cooperstown, population 2,200, to embark on this new endeavor. And it was a wonderful time in our lives.
We're talking to Dale Petroski in a quote, if you will. "Dale worked hard to improve relations between the Hall of Fame and Major League Baseball. And he succeeded because of who he is and his belief, which I share, that we're all much better when we work together." Bud Selig, Commissioner, Major League Baseball. And I'm Jack Rasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR.
Now back to Anything Is Possible with Jack Rasula on News Talk 760 WJR.
We're with a modern-day Horatio Alger story, Dale Petroski. Dale, how hard is it to make the Baseball Hall of Fame?
Well, I want everybody who goes out to Comerica Park the next time to think about this. There are 3 million little leaguers playing baseball in this country this year, and a small percentage of them will ever play in high school. You think about those first T-ball teams, there are not many high school players in there. And if you play in high school and want to play in college, the chances are 1 in 20, 5% that a high school player is going to play in college, any level. Every year the major leagues have a draft. And the 30 clubs get together in Orlando, Florida in June, and they draft 900 American players and 600 international players. 900 American players is not many. These are the best high school and college players who are eligible. And if that young man signs a contract and goes to the minor leagues, he's a professional baseball player. He gets paid to play baseball. Not many of us ever get paid to play baseball. What are his chances of ever stepping foot on a major league field? 1 in 20. 1 out of 20 players drafted and signed ever see the major leagues. So the Tigers in June will draft 50 players, and 2 of them will ever see the major leagues. 48 of them will never get to the major leagues. First of all, that's how difficult it is to get to the major leagues. Now, if a player gets to the major leagues, what are his chances of staying in the major leagues? 1/3 of players will retire with less than 1 year of service. Think about that. 1/3 of players will retire with less than 1 year of service. two-thirds of players won't make it to the five-year mark. Only a third of players will play at least 5 years in the major leagues. So that's how difficult it is to get there and to stay there. Now, how difficult is it to make it to the Hall of Fame? 1 out of 100 players who have ever played this game at the major league level makes it to the Hall of Fame. So if the Tigers tonight are playing the Indians, there are 25 players in the Tiger dugout and 25 players in the Indians dugout. That's only 50 players. You need another game's worth of players to find one Hall of Famer. So that's how special Cooperstown is. That's how hard it is to have a plaque in Cooperstown.
Please tell us that you didn't get all of these facts from Yogi Berra. What would Yogi say how hard it is to get it?
Yogi is he's a wonderful guy. He's a gem.
You told me once the difference between a 250 hitter and a 300 hitter.
Yeah, that's two hits a week, Jack. You think about that. Average player, let's say they play six games a week, and they get four at-bats a night. That's 24 at-bats. And a 250 hitter gets six hits, right?
Yes.
And a 320 hitter gets eight hits. So it's two hits. And those could be bloops. They could be topped balls, swinging bunts, whatever it is. But I tend to think that everything evens out. If you hit a line drive to the left fielder and you hit it on the nose and it's right at him, you're going to get a bloop hit somewhere along the way to make up for that. I do believe those things even out.
All us Cubs fans realize it all evens out, Dale. It all evens out.
Well, maybe not for the Cubs.
Our time is coming. We're talking to Dale Petroski. Don Sutton told him once, Dale, you've been handed the keys to the Vatican. Dale, talk to us about the role baseball played in civil rights in this country.
Oh, yeah. Well, it was huge. As you know, the country has always struggled with civil rights, especially pre-World War II. And things seemed to really open up to the point where, I think we should all be proud that we have an African-American president today. You think about where we were 50 years ago and where we are today. Incredible. But a lot of that started with Jackie Robinson. And in 1947, of course, there was a lot of opposition to Jackie Robinson being allowed to play in the major leagues, but Branch Rickey and Mr. O'Malley were able to get it through and to give Jackie a chance. And once Jackie came along and proved his worth, a lot of other great players came along. Don Newcomb and Joe Black and Frank Robinson and Willie Mays and Ernie Banks.
Yes.
Lots and lots of players proved that not only were they worthy, but they were the stars of the league for a long time. And that's why the National League was dominant for so many years, is because they signed the black players and the American League didn't. And so they were winning lots and lots of all-star games, and the better teams are coming out of the National League, the Dodgers, and then the Milwaukee Braves with Hank Aaron, the Pirates with Clemente, Banks with the Cubs. So it was a really amazing moment, but civil rights and opportunity has always shown its way in baseball. After the black players, it was the Latino players, and now it's the Asian players. So whenever a new immigrant group is coming to America and assimilating their way, often the way is led by the baseball players.
Tell us, if you will, a little bit about Babe Ruth.
Gosh, well, the Babe was unbelievable. When he hit his 60 home runs in 1927, that was 1/7 of all the home runs hit in Major League Baseball that year. So you think about that. That was 14% of all the home runs hit in baseball. That's how dominant, that's how good he was. He was hitting more home runs by himself than entire teams through much of his career. And, of course, he was a great player in Boston. And Boston won World Series with the Babe. People forget that. They didn't win since, up until 2004. But he was a great pitcher. And when he went to New York, they made him a full-time hitter. And New York, of course, makes a lot of legends. And if you can play in New York and play well in New York, you get a lot of attention. And the Babe was just great for the game in the 20s. And the Yankees began their run when the Babe went there and sort of hasn't stopped since. But Babe Ruth was a larger-than-life figure who everybody loved. And He was he loved every child. He was never unwilling to pose for a picture with anybody. He loved the camera. He loved signing autographs. And he was probably baseball's first great ambassador.
Let's talk, if you will, about a couple that we've lost recently. An MSU alum, Robin Roberts.
Oh, one of my favorite people, Robin Roberts. You know, he went to MSU to play basketball. And then they had him at third base, and they one day asked him to pitch. But I got very close to Robin when I was at the Hall of Fame. Just loved his sense of humor, loved his sensibility. He was a Midwesterner who just was a straight-talking, straight-shooting guy with a twinkle in his eye, and just loved him. And he and his wife, Mary. Mary died in 2006, and so I used to invite Robin to everything that the Hall was doing after that because I knew that he enjoyed it, and he was a little bit lonely. And then last May, we lost Robin. Thank God it was quick. He died of a stroke as well. But I spent evenings in Robin's home. In fact, the night of Mary's funeral, Robin invited me to stay with him and keep him company. And we were very close, and I really, really miss him.
One more, our own Sparky.
You had to love Sparky. Mr. Enthusiasm, Mr. Fun, loved everybody. Always, I think, I got a sense from Sparky that he found the humor in the fact that the son of a painter from South Dakota could grow up to be famous. And he saw the irony in all of that. But he was a very smart guy in his own way. He was a little bit like Yogi in that he knew what he was saying. Nobody else did. He knew what he was saying, and he knew what he meant. But he was a great leader. You know, Joe Morgan told me the story about when Sparky was managing the Reds, and he was in spring training, and the team has finally assembled the 25 guys, and he called them around. He said, "The rules are the same for 21 of you." And they all looked up at him and said, "What do you mean 21 of us?" He said, Joe Morgan, Johnny Bench, Pete Rose, and Tony Perez, they've earned the right to be treated differently than the rest of you guys." And I never forgot that Sparky was managing individuals, and he knew that every human being had different needs and wants. Johnny told me that Sparky used to call those four into his office before they would send somebody down or before they were thinking about making a trade and get their opinion. He wanted them to sort of be assistant coaches with him because he knew that they were in a different category. He was a psychologist extraordinaire.
We're talking to Dale Petrosky, and Dale only knows one way to treat every human being he ever meets, and that's special. And I'm Jack Crisula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR.
You're listening to Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR.
We're with Dale Petrosky, and here's another quote from a friend. Dale has had one of the most interesting careers I know of, and it's not surprising. Every time I'm with him, I learn something new. Warren Buffett of Berkshire Hathaway. Tall cotton, Dale Petrosky. You give a speech today, Dale, and the title of the speech is Life Lessons from Inside the White House, National Geographic, and the Baseball Hall of Fame. What's the speech about?
Well, I focus on three things, and I really use examples from my time in the White House and National Geographic and the Baseball Hall of Fame. And I think one of the reasons that the audience can relate to it is I talk about people who I know, but they all know too. I mean, they are people who are household names. And I focus on three things, Jack. One, first is nothing great happens without clarity. You have to have clarity in your life or in your mission, what you're trying to pursue, and before you go after it. So it's got to be clear in your mind. And the second thing I talk about is the truly great are truly humble. And I've really learned that along the way. And then the third thing I talk about is you're going to get a lot of advice in life. You got to know when to take the advice and when not to take the advice. Do we have time to talk about some examples?
Yes, sir.
Okay. The clarity issue is an interesting one, and I think a lot of people don't really know the story. In 1954, Ronald Reagan was on the downside of his acting career. He was getting a little bit older. And as luck would have it, television was coming along. And General Electric approached Ronald Reagan to host a Sunday night TV show called GE Theater. It was a movie, and he would just introduce it and so forth. The second part of his deal with GE was to travel around the country and talk to audiences about, you know, Hollywood and General Electric and so forth. And so Ronald Reagan made this trip to 139 plants over the next 8 years, out to middle America, about 200 people in each plant, and he would give a speech about Hollywood, tell a few stories. But then he started talking about free enterprise, and that struck a chord with the folks in those settings. There was no media in the rooms, and he would travel by himself, write his speech on yellow legal pads by hand, and if after the speech he would take questions and answers, the little lady in the back would ask a question, and she used a better word than he did in his speech. He would go back to his hotel room afterwards, cross out his word and use her word. He did this for 8 years. He knew what he believed when he started that in 1954, but by having a conversation with the American people outside of the public glare for 8 years and honing his words and his message, he became very clear about what he stood for, what America stood for. And so when people, after his presidency, said he was amazing because he was symbiotic with the American people, that was not by accident. That was by listening to the American people for 8 years and hearing their language and really using it back on them. And that's why he was so clear in his thinking and in his presenting. As far as the truly great or truly humble, Ronald Reagan certainly fits into that category. Gil Grosvenor, the chairman of National Geographic, certainly fits into that category. But Juan Marichal is one I think of. Juan Marichal grew up very poor in the Dominican Republic, and he took me a couple of years ago to all the sites of his childhood in the Dominican and showed me where he grew up. And after about 3 days of, we couldn't go anywhere without people wanting his autograph or touching him, and these were people who hadn't bathed in a couple weeks, who, you know, didn't wear shoes. I said to him, Juan, you're so patient with these people, and he's so wonderful. He said, Dale, you don't understand. That should be me. This should not be me. That should be me. That's the way I grew up. And I love my people, and I love, if they want something from me, I'll drop anything to give it to them. The third thing is knowing when to take advice and when not to take advice. I'll just tell you one quick story about when not to take advice. Wade Boggs was a great hitter with the Red Sox, was hitting 360 every year, goes to spring training, and Ted Williams is the hitting instructor in spring training for the Red Sox. And he says, you know, Wade, you're a good hitter, but you're not going to be a great hitter until you hit for power and average. Boggs hit about 12 home runs a year, and Williams thought he should hit more. So he worked with him for about 3 days. Finally, at the end of the third day, Wade said to him, Mr. Williams, I appreciate everything you've done for me, but you know what? I'm going to do it my way. And Wade Boggs stuck with his method of hitting his 12 home runs, but a lot of doubles, and his 350 average, and it took him all the way to the Hall of Fame. Not so sure if he had gone for the power, if that average would have stayed up there, and if he had ever would have ever made it to Cooperstown. So it takes a big man to stand up to Ted Williams, but Wade knew when not to take advice.
Speaking of doing it your way, Dale Petrosky, you always see the best in others and are extremely reluctant to ever criticize anyone. Why?
Because I believe that people are inherently good. And I believe that if they act badly or, you know, maybe do something that's not right, there's a reason for that. And I'm not making excuses for people, but I do believe that if given the right environment and given the right encouragement, everybody can do well, and everybody wants to do well, and everybody wants to be nice and kind and helpful. But sometimes things get in the way, and I think it's our job to try to make the world a good place and make the world a positive place and give them the kind of atmosphere and environment they need in order to succeed and feel good about themselves.
The art of listening. Talk to us about listening.
Well, I think the most important part of communicating is listening, because you can pick up an awful lot by what others say. and start to understand them. And this gets back to your previous question about finding the good in people. I think if you listen to people and pick up clues about where they've been or where they are at this moment in their lives, you get a good sense of what it is that needs to be done to put them in a good position to win and to do well. And, you know, I think pulling ideas together from various people in meetings and then summarizing at the end is a way to build consensus. And I do believe that we do work better when we work together and we all have a common goal. And so I think listening is more important than talking, although obviously it's important to be able to communicate a message. But listening to me comes first.
Last question, what advice would you give to our young listeners tonight?
You know, I tell audiences, young audiences, that these six words will hold you in good stead and really give you a good chance for a good life and a good career. And the six words are very simple. Work really hard and be really nice. Because if you work hard and are really nice, that's a rare combination. Some people work really hard but forget the nice thing. Some people are really nice but forget to work hard. If you do both of those, people are going to recognize you as a productive worker, but they're also going to give you an awful lot of opportunities because they want to be around you and they want that positive energy that you are expending to be part of their environment too. So I think that's the best advice I can give the young people.
Dale Petrosky, you live that every day. While what you've done is unbelievable, how you've done it is what we all most admire you for. Keep it up.
Thank you, Jack. I really appreciate it. You humble me with your words.
Thank you. Please join us next Sunday. Until then, I'm Jack Krasula. Thanks for listening. And make it a great week, because with God, anything is possible. Spahn.
Believe in yourself.